Chapter 7. I didn't even know they were sore at us. Commander Logan Ramsey jumped up from his desk at the Patwing 2 Command Center on Ford Island. He had been working out a search plan for the sub reported by the PBY when a single dive bomber screamed down on the seaplane ramp at the southern tip of the island. It looked like a young aviator flat-hatting, and both he and the duty officer tried to get the offender's number, but they were too late, and Ramsey remarked that it was going to be hard to find out who it was. Then a blast, a column of dirt and smoke, erupted from the foot of the ramp. "Never mind," said Ramsey. "It's a Jap." The plane pulled out of its dive and veered up the channel between Ford Island and 1010 Dock. It passed less than 600 feet from Rear Admiral William Furlong as he paced the deck of his flagship, the antique mine layer Oglala. The admiral took one glance at the flaming orange-red circle on the fuselage and understood too. He shouted for general quarters, and as SOPA, senior officer present afloat, he hoisted the signal, "All ships in harbor sortie." The time was 7:55 a.m. Now two more planes screeched down. This time the aim was perfect. Parts of the big PBY hangar at the head of the ramp flew in all directions. Radioman Harry Meade, member of a utility plane squadron based on the island, couldn't understand why American planes were bombing the place. Seaman Robert Oborn of the same outfit had a plausible explanation. It was an Army snafu. Boy, he thought, is somebody going to catch it for putting live bombs on those planes? All this passed unnoticed by Ensign Donald Korn of the cruiser Raleigh, moored on the northwest side of Ford Island at one of the berths normally used by the carriers. He was turning over his deck watch to Ensign William Game and couldn't see much of anything happening down by the seaplane ramp, but he did have a fine view of the valley leading up the center of Oahu. At 7:56, he noticed some planes flying in low from that direction. Now they were gliding past the algaroba trees at Pearl City. Splitting up, two headed for the Utah just astern, one for the Detroit just ahead, and one for the Raleigh herself. Ensign Korn, thinking the planes were Marines on maneuvers, called out his anti-aircraft crews to practice with them. The men were just taking their stations when the torpedo struck home about opposite the second funnel. A shattering roar, a sickening lurch. Through a blinding mixture of smoke and dirt and muddy water, men caught a brief glimpse of the Raleigh's splintered church launch. It had been easing alongside where the torpedo hit. The Detroit got off scot-free, but the Utah shuddered under two solid blows. Watching from the destroyer Monaghan, several hundred yards to the north, Bosun's mate Thomas Donahue thought that this time the U.S. Army really had a hole in its head. A fifth plane in this group saved its torpedo, skimmed across Ford Island, and let fly at the Oglala and Helena, moored side by side at 1010 Dock, the berth normally used by the battleship Pennsylvania, flagship of the whole Pacific Fleet. The torpedo passed completely under the Oglala, moored outboard, and barreled into the Helena midships. Her engine room clock stopped at 7:57. The concussion burst the seams of the old Oglala alongside, hurling musician Don Rodenberger from his upper bunk. He could only think that the ancient boilers had finally exploded. Ensign Roman Leo Brooks, officer of the deck on the West Virginia across the channel, was thinking along these same lines. He, too, was in no position to see the plane diving on the seaplane hangars or on the ships moored across Ford Island. All he saw was the sudden eruption of flames and smoke at 1010 Dock. He lost no time. In seconds, the ship's bugler and PA system were blaring, "Away the fire and rescue party." Even the men who saw the planes couldn't understand. One of them was Fireman Frank Stock of the repair ship Vestal, moored alongside the Arizona along Battleship Row. Stock and six of his mates had taken the church launch for services ashore. They moved across the channel and into Southeast Lock, that long, narrow strip of water pointing directly at the battleships. On their right, they passed the cruisers, nosed into the Navy Yard piers. On the left, some subs tucked into their berths. As they reached the Mary's Point landing at the end of the lock, six or eight torpedo planes flew in low from the east, about 50 feet above the water, and heading down the lock toward the battleships. The men were mildly surprised. They had never seen U.S. planes come in from that direction. They were even more surprised when the rear seat gunners sprayed them with machine gun bullets. Then Stock recalled the stories he had read about battle condition maneuvers in the southern states. This must be the same idea. For extra realism, they had even painted red circles on the planes. The truth finally dawned when one of his friends caught a slug in the stomach from the fifth plane that passed. On the Nevada at the northern end of Battleship Row, leader Odin McMillan waited with his band to play Morning Colors at 8 o'clock. His 23 men had been in position since 7:55 when the blue prep signal went up. As they moved into formation, some of the musicians noticed planes diving at the other end of Ford Island. McMillan saw a lot of dirt and sand go up, but thought it was another drill. Now it was 7:58, 2 minutes to go, and planes started coming in low from Southeast Lock. Heavy, muffled explosions began booming down the line, enough to worry anyone. And then it was 8 o'clock. The band crashed into the Star-Spangled Banner. A Japanese plane skimmed across the harbor, dropped a torpedo at the Arizona, and peeled off right over the Nevada's fantail. The rear gunner sprayed the men standing at attention, but he must have been a poor shot. He missed the entire band and Marine Guard, lined up in two neat rows. He did succeed in shredding the flag, which was just being raised. McMillan knew now, but kept on conducting. The years of training had taken over. It never occurred to him that once he had begun playing the national anthem, he could possibly stop. Another strafer flashed by. This time McMillan unconsciously paused as the deck splintered around him, but he quickly picked up the beat again. The entire band stopped and started again with him, as though they had rehearsed it for weeks. Not a man broke formation until the final note died. Then everyone ran wildly for cover. Ensign Joe Tausig, officer of the deck, pulled the alarm bell. The ship's bugler got ready to blow general quarters, but Tausig took the bugle and tossed it overboard. Somehow it seemed too much like make-believe at a time like this. Instead, he shouted over the PA system again and again, "All hands, general quarters, air raid, this is no drill." Ship after ship began to catch on. The executive officer of the supply ship Castor shouted, "The Japs are bombing us, the Japs are bombing us." For an instant, Seaman Bill Dees drew a blank and wondered whether the man was speaking to him. On the submarine Tautog, the topside anchor watch shouted down the forward torpedo hatch, "The war is on, no fooling." Everybody was racing for the alarm signals now. On the little gunboat Sacramento in the Navy Yard, Seaman Charles Bonestad dashed over to pull the switch, lost the race to a mess attendant. On the cruiser Phoenix, out where the destroyers were moored, the loudspeaker had just announced, "Lay up to the quarterdeck, the Catholic Church party." Then the general alarm bell drowned out anything else. On Battleship Row, the Maryland's bugler blew general quarters over the PA system, while the ship's klaxon lent added authority. The Oklahoma's call to arms needed no extra punch. First came an air raid alert, then general quarters a minute later. This time, the voice on the PA system added a few well-chosen words, which one crew member recalls as follows. "Real planes, real bombs. This is no drill." Other witnesses have a less delicate version of the last part. The language alone, they say, convinced them that this was it. But on most ships, the men down below still needed convincing. Even as the torpedo hit, fireman Joseph Messier of the Helena was sure the alarm bell was just another of the executive officer's bright ideas to get the crew to go to church. "This is a hell of a time to hold general drills," echoed through the firemen's quarters of the California, the signalman's compartment on the San Francisco, the after head on the Nevada. On the destroyer Phelps, machinist's mate William Taylor engaged in a sort of one-man slowdown. He deliberately took plenty of time getting dressed. Then he ambled topside, yawned, and strolled toward the stern to get a drink of water before going below to his station in the boiler room. As he started down the after gangway, a chief gunner's mate came charging down behind him, shouting, "Get the hell out of the way! Don't you know we're at war?" Taylor thought to himself, "You mumbling jackass, isn't this drill enough without adding harassment from you?" Commander Harold Stout, skipper of the destroyer Minecraft Breeze, was even more annoyed. He had left standing orders never to test general quarters before 8 on Sunday. When the alarm sounded, he left his breakfast to chew out the watch. Captain Harold C. Train, Admiral Pye's chief of staff on the California, was sure the alarm had been set off by mistake. And on the destroyer Henley, it really was a mistake. Her crew was normally mustered on Sundays at 7:55 by sounding the gas attack alarm. This morning, someone pressed the wrong button, general quarters. Chaplain Howell Forgy of the cruiser New Orleans also thought someone had blundered. He drifted to his station in sickbay, completely unconcerned. A moment later, the ship's doctor arrived and hesitantly remarked, "Padre, there's planes out there, and they look like Japs." The word spread faster. A bosun dashed into the CPO wardroom on the Maryland, sat down white as a sheet. "The Japs are here." As Ensign Charles Merdinger of the Nevada pulled on his clothes, someone outside his stateroom yelled, "It's the real thing, it's the Japs." With that, Merdinger stepped completely through his sock. Wartender Samuel Kuchik looked into the head on the destroyer tender Dobbin, called to fireman Charles Leahy, "You better cut that short, Charlie, the Japs are here." A few skeptics still held out. In the Honolulu's hoist room, Private Roy Henry bet another Marine a dollar that it was the Army, pulling a surprise on the Navy with dummy torpedoes. The men in the repair ship Rigel's pipe and copper shop remained unperturbed when a seaman wearing only underwear burst in with the news. They figured the fellow was pretending he was crazy so he could get back to the coast. When a sailor on the Pennsylvania said the Japs were attacking, machinist's mate William Felsing had a snappy comeback. "So are the Germans." The last doubts vanished in an avalanche of shattering evidence. Pharmacist's mate William Lynch took a skeptical metalsmith to his porthole on the California, pointed to the chaos erupting outside. The man sagged away, sighing, "Jesus Christ, Jesus Christ." On the West Virginia, a sailor spattered with fuel oil ran by Ensign Maurice Featherman, shouting, "Look what the bastards did to me." One and all, they accepted it now, some with a worldly grasp of affairs, some with almost ingenuous innocence. Captain Mervyn Benyon, skipper of the West Virginia, calmly remarked to his Marine orderly, "This is certainly in keeping with their history of surprise attacks." A seaman on the destroyer Monaghan told bosun's mate Thomas Donahue, "Hell, I didn't even know they were sore at us." Down the corridors, up the ladders, through the hatches, the men ran, climbed, milled, and shoved toward their battle stations. And it was high time. The alarm was no sooner given when the Oklahoma took the first of five torpedoes, the West Virginia the first of six.